Support for First Coast Connect is provided in part by Baptist Health.
Good morning. I'm Ann Schindler, and this is First Coast Connect. Today, an assassination attempt roils an already turbulent presidential election. We discuss the security concerns and political consequences of Saturday's attack on the former president. Later in the program, a new podcast explores how turn-of-the-century Jacksonville was shaped by and helped shape early American filmmaking. But first, an attack on former President Donald Trump causes a seismic shift in the political landscape. The shooting at a weekend rally had immediate impacts for both the tenor of the political contest and the safety apparatus of both campaigns. To discuss it, I'm joined now by retired federal law enforcement officer, safety analyst, and professional risk consultant Mark Bachman. Good morning, Mark.
Good morning.
I'm also joined here by longtime political consultant and campaign manager John Daigle. Good morning, John.
Morning, Ann. Thanks.
And a note to listeners, this segment is being pre-recorded Monday morning, July 15th, but we will take your calls and questions after the segment. You can reach out at 904-549-2937. You can also email firstcoastconnect@wjct.org or reach out on social media by tagging us on Facebook, Instagram, or X. Mark, let's start with you. Bring us up to speed on what we know now about what happened.
Well, what we know now, what happened, at least with the shooter, Matthew Crooks, I guess he goes by Matthew. Yeah, he's a 20-year-old white male, living, I think, with his parents, had access to firearms, obviously had some rudimentary type explosive devices in the house and in the car. Still don't have a motive as to why he did what he did. Went to the rally, got very, very close, too close, and got up on a roof and started firing at former President Trump, as well as hitting individuals in the crowd, ultimately taking the life of one of the people attending the rally. For now, I mean, you have a coordinated effort with the federal authorities working it backwards, obviously, and obviously they're going to go back and look at what the Secret Service did and didn't do in the process of this rally as far as protecting not just former President Trump, but also the attendees.
So we are also hearing, I'm sure we've all been hearing these accounts from eyewitnesses, several saying that they tried to warn law enforcement about the presence of an armed man on that roof before the shooting happened. Explain to us, how is it possible that the law enforcement officials, if they were indeed warned about this, did not respond in some fashion and respond more quickly?
You know, when you have events like this, you have the Secret Service is running the show pretty much. And they show up and they run it. You have the Pittsburgh field office that's probably going to coordinate it with the Protective Service detail team that's with former President Trump. The Pittsburgh field office goes out, Secret Service office goes out and makes all the arrangements. They have the itinerary. They plan to, give the state and local authorities and provide, the security measures around the perimeter as well within the rally. Could be the sheriff's office in coordination with the police department there. Butler's about 40 miles from Pittsburgh. So there are some resources available, but it's a fairly bucolic area. But still they'll cover that whole perimeter in that area. The biggest problem sometimes is the communication. I don't know how they were communicating, if they had a mutual aid frequency they were talking on. Usually that's provided, and maybe that information didn't get relayed quick enough. I know in some of the interviews to some of the attendees, clearly they were making law enforcement aware of Crooks climbing up a building and getting on a roof nearby the rally itself.
Does it appear at this point, though, that perimeter that was established, that security perimeter, did not include this adjacent building? Therefore, the people that were near or around that building weren't being screened, for instance, for having a weapon of some kind?
Yes, it was pretty clear that that building, there should have been somebody on top of that building. A law enforcement representative should have been up there, whether it be one of the Secret Service snipers, the state, local, whoever it may be. And that just didn't happen. I mean, Crooks was roughly a little over between 150 and 130 yards away, which is, with a rifle. You know, I grew up in Pennsylvania. I'm in Pennsylvania right now. A lot of people shoot guns up here. A lot of people hunt. I don't know what he did. He had a membership at a gun club. So it's pretty clear he knew how to work that weapon. I think what startled him was probably law enforcement getting up on that roof. One of the officers, it looks like, got hoisted to the roof and took a peek. He turned and pointed the gun at him and then quickly turned away and started firing anywhere from 6 to 8 rounds into the crowd, all, you know, hitting some of the individuals, taking the life of one individual and hitting former President Trump in the ear.
And as we know, the former president is recovering and was injured, but not, you know, in a severe fashion. John, this is already a very tumultuous political time. Help us understand how this event changes things for both sides.
Yeah, I mean, obviously there's a short-term change, and we heard of very different tones from both candidates over the weekend. President Biden did a news conference Sunday morning and the speech from the Oval Office last night, both of which he came off sounding very presidential and really kind of used that theme of unity. It's former President Trump has told media outlets that he has torn up his speech and he's writing a new unifying consolatory speech. And the appearance is that it may have changed the tone, but I'm skeptical. I really don't think in the long run, either the attempted assassination event or President Biden's poor performance in the debate 3 weeks ago will have long-term lasting impacts on the election. It's 113 days away. That's 113 news cycles. We have two conventions. We have possibly another debate and a vice presidential debate. There's a lot that's going to happen between now and November 5th, and I'm not sure if either event, the assassination attempt or the debate performance from Biden, has long-term lasting impacts on the trajectory of this race.
That's very surprising to me. And we should say we're not minimizing, you know, the safety issue here or the human side of this, but there obviously are very real political considerations given the nature of this race, how close it is, the consequences. The call for unity is interesting. This has been a very divisive, obviously, political world of late. I saw that Melania Trump issued a kind of lengthy tweet also calling for unity, a kind of very emotional tweet talking about her husband as a, you know, as a person and the impact that it would have had on her and their son. How much, like, as someone who's worked on campaigns, what do you think is happening behind the scenes when you have a speech like, or not a speech like that, but rather a long statement like that issued by the First Lady? Who's helping to craft that? What are the considerations that go into that?
Well, I am sure that Trump's advisors would love for him to adopt a new conciliatory, more unifying theme. And you may see some of that from Trump at the convention. I really don't believe that's in his DNA in the long run. I'm skeptical that he can maintain sort of the Reagan-esque unifying theme throughout the debate. One of the worst things you can do as a political consultant is to try and make a candidate something they're not. Typically, the public sees through it and they appear kind of phony. I don't know that Trump is a natural unifier, and I don't know that trying to shift and become that will work in his advantage. It comes down to this whole race, and again, I've had this conversation with people after the debate. We're talking about an incredibly small number of voters who are likely voters who are persuadable in this race. 99.5% of voters in this race have told pollsters over and over again that their opinion cannot change. We're talking about 6% of voters in 6 key swing states. It's almost the number of voters in Duval County.
Wow.
And they're going to be $10 billion in advertising spent trying to move those 600, 700,000 voters in those 6 swing states over the next 100 days. I'm not sure that either one of these events, you know, will have a major impact on the 99% of likely voters who have already made up their mind.
So just a reminder to listeners, this segment is being pre-recorded Monday morning, July 15th, but we will take your calls and questions after this segment. You can reach out at 904-549-2937. You can also email firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Mark Bachman, the start of the Republican National Convention is just hours away at this point. How does this incident impact that event from a safety standpoint?
You'll have some heightened security measures, obviously, put in place in light of what happened. Just to recap, former President Trump, he he has a large following. People like to go out and see him. They like to hear him. His constituents, they're very loyal to him. So there's a massive amount of people that show up at these events. When you have those large numbers, that creates more of a problem for security measures, whether they're there to cheer him on or not, or whatever. The Secret Service has the responsibility of assessing what's going on in that crowd. They do in advance. They do, obviously, the security measures in place when the event's going on. Then afterwards, they do a recap of what they did or should have done. Each area, even though Butler is small, it presents its own problems, a smaller area because of the just a more rural area, resources may be less. A larger area, you have more resources, but you obviously have more people. So every time they have to assess and weigh what they're going to do as far as security measures. With the convention coming up, you've got a lot of political people there. You have all types of people there, and a number of people could be considered targets to somebody who's not liking a particular side or whatever. So they're going to take all that into consideration. The security measures will definitely be heightened.
Do you think that there'll be any changes to the number of attendees? Would that be possible? Would that be reasonable at this point to try to rein in just the size of the crowd?
Yeah, I think they may end up, you know, keeping a better number, you know, fixed on it with inside the convention. I don't know how many that, you know, what the size is, where that, you know, how many people are going to be in there, but they're going to monitor that. They're going to safeguard it. They're going to use a lot of technology that they may have didn't use up in Butler, you know, and again, they're going back, you know, right now it looks like Crooks is just somebody that's a lone wolf that's had some issues growing up. And I can't speak to what his mindset was. I don't know if they found some form of a manifesto that he's written, you know, so that sometimes happens, but going forward, you know, if it's an organized group of people that are trying to cause problems, that presents a whole nother security problem. If you have multiple shooters, you have individuals that are working in unison with one another trying to do something. I think there's going to be disruption at the convention anyway. So I think they're preparing for that.
Wisely. So, I mean, John, we had already heard that there was going to be protests planned prior to this. Mm-hmm. From a political standpoint, I mean, I know you're saying that, you know, we're hearing Donald Trump ripping up his speech, starting over. It's worth noting that one of his key political advisors is Susie Wiles, who's from Duval County, who has a long political history here and is considered a huge influence and resource for him. How much of this this shift do you think is just from a political standpoint an opportunity in some ways for a reset or a new direction for the campaign?
I mean, I think it's a fantastic opportunity. And Susie, who is extremely smart about this, I'm sure is trying to convince not only former President Trump, but those around him about the opportunity this exists. And again, it goes back to how you get those 6% of voters in those swing states. If Trump is able to, and his campaign are able to jump on this opportunity, I think it could be huge. I'm just not sure, again, as I said before, that he's capable of making the kind of shift that would be required for him to take advantage of this opportunity. I would expect, this will help him with his base, just as Biden's speeches over the weekend probably helped him with his base. You're going to see a very fiery convention. What I would probably expect is you will see the other speakers at the convention come out very combative, very defiant, very fiery, and then Trump to come out with his speech as more of a unifying effect. That would be strategically what should happen. I'd be very interested to see if Trump's able to adopt that tone, even though I'm sure advisors like Wiles and others around him are saying this is a perfect opportunity for him to do so.
There appeared to be almost a little bit of a disconnect initially because some of the people that are, contending for his, at this point, still unnamed VP, running mate, some of the people that are close to him, including his campaign manager, his son, initially coming out, you know, basically blaming Democrats for creating an environment in which this happened, or more directly blaming the current president, Joe Biden, for language that he's been using. It's interesting politically because it does sort of flip the script on what I think Democrats have said about an environment that has been incendiary and language that has been, you know, kind of bellicose from the former president and his camp. But initially, there was a lot of not quite mixed messages, but very strenuous tweets and statements. And then there was this sort of silence where tweets were deleted. There was a statement that went out, a directive from the Trump's people to basically don't make any public statements.
Yeah, I mean, we saw some really opportunistic and frankly irresponsible tweets coming out in the first 24 hours after this. We saw elected officials, national elected officials, openly tweeting about the fact that the president had ordered the hit. We saw some very opportunistic messaging from some of the more incendiary members of Congress. And you're right, they did effectively shut that down by Sunday morning, Sunday afternoon. How long they'll be able to keep a lid on that, we'll be interested to see. The conventions are times of high emotions and high loyalty, and I think you won't be able to keep a lid on those kind of comments. I don't think it in the long run, you know, you're never, those conspiracy theorists out there, you're just not going to be able to quiet them. They're going to be there. The key question is whether the main leaders, whoever the vice presidential pick is and Trump, and whether they promote those kind of theories or not. We saw, you know, a couple tweets I saw over the weekend kind of trying to adopt in the days after the Reagan assassination attempt in 81, he famously told, had this conversation with his doctor where he asked the doctor whether he was a Republican or a Democrat. And the doctor replied, well, you know, we're all Republicans today. There were some people trying to take that. I saw one tweet this weekend that said, oh, we're all MAGA today. And I just don't know that that flies in today's environment as much as it did in 1981 after the Reagan assassination attempt. So I guess what I'm expecting to see is a convention with a lot of fire and a lot of very incendiary comments. And I don't think the assassination attempt soften that. I think it will heighten it, if anything.
Mark, you were alluding to, you know, what we know about the shooter at this point. We do know that he does somewhat fit a profile of someone who is involved in a shooting of some kind, of really of any kind, in terms of being, you know, a white male, you know, in that age group of, you know, in his 20s. But this is obviously an isolated incident. That this is not, you know, considered part of any larger attack or effort, as far as we know. Is that correct?
Yeah, right now, I think that's what it looks like. If I can just play off of what John said, is that this kind of fervor back and forth makes it really tough for law enforcement and security measures. It's only going to make it the job harder to protect individuals that are bantering back and forth if this language continues between both parties. It needs to stop. It needs to be more unifying, if anything, one way or the other. I mean, you know, you do what you do at the ballot box. And I'm not getting into the political side of it. I'm just speaking from a security standpoint that type of, I mean, I don't know what drove Crooks to do this, what he was looking at on social media. They're going to go through all his social media. They're going to look at it. They're going to look at his phone. But sometimes this type of, vile comments, all the stuff that's put out there on all the social media sites pushes people into this place. You know, we don't know what his mental instability, obviously there's some issues there. And I don't know, you know, obviously they haven't talked much to his parents, but they need to, obviously. I mean, he had explosive devices in the house. He had them in the car. He had access to an AR-15 rifle. Those are things that are going to have to be looked at going forward. And those individuals potentially could be out there again, causing, you know, or thinking this way.
What do you expect is happening right now behind the scenes, Mark, in terms of trying to determine what happened, what went wrong, who, if anyone, would be held accountable in the world of law enforcement for permitting this to happen?
Well, like I said before, when we started, was Secret Service runs the show. So when they show up to do a protective service detail, that team that's with Donald Trump stays with Donald Trump. That may change. Those individuals may change. I mean, I don't know. They're going to obviously look at the personnel, how they did things, how they carried it out, how their association with local law enforcement. Are they going to give them a local law enforcement maybe a greater role in this? Local law enforcement typically doesn't make the call on this. Secret Service tells them what they need, and then there's joint communication and coordination to carry it out. Secret Service they have a uniform branch, but not in these particular incidences. So they rely on state locals for that uniform presence, that omnipresence that's there. The snipers that were on the roof, I don't know if they made a determination. They keep saying they're Secret Service people, but they could have been state and local people that were just put up on the roof as well. Again, this is, these measures are all going to be taken in consideration. There's going to be some great scrutiny on what happened there in Butler. And going forward, you'll see some changes, trust me.
John Daigle, what, if any, reaction locally are you seeing from our lawmakers, or are you looking for in terms of messaging, in terms of how they're responding?
I mean, I did see comments from the head of the Duval GOP and from Mayor Deegan's office, and they were fairly predictable. I mean, I didn't see anything locally that stood out to me as incendiary, or I think most of the local elected officials and party representatives on both sides, you know, understood the gravity of the moment and treated it appropriately. I think we saw a lot of that at the national level too. I think it comes down to, as I said before, will it last?
And as a someone who's been involved in these kinds of campaigns, obviously not with this sort of level of intensity, but what would you be advising your clients right now if you were in this circumstance as a Democrat or as a Republican?
Well, I think Biden had a great opportunity to look presidential, and I think he took advantage of that. I have mixed feelings about whether I would advise Trump to adopt the unity tone that a lot of folks are talking about and maybe looking for at the thing. It comes down to, again, would it be great to go after those persuadable voters who are still out there? Probably yes. But would a different tone and him trying to be somebody he's not impact him with his base? I think that could be the negative. I think overall it comes down to this stage of the game. You cannot change, you know, someone's fundamental nature. Trump has to be who he is, and I'm sure Susie Wiles knows that. So I don't know that he's positioned to take advantage of the opportunity that is in front of him because of this. He's not Ronald Reagan, and he's not able to use this event the way Reagan did in 81.
Well, Mark Bachman, John Daigle, thank you both so much for being here. We appreciate your insights. We're going to be back in just a minute with your comments and questions. You can reach us at 904-549-2937. You can also email firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. We'll be back in just a minute. Welcome back. So we're live now. I'm still joined by John Daigle, longtime political consultant and campaign manager, former political reporter. Mm-hmm. Glad to have you, John. We've been discussing the assassination attempt over the weekend of the former president, and we welcome your calls and comments. John, there was something that you were talking about earlier, which is the VP choice. So mm-hmm. That is as yet to be announced. There's still a few people in the running, but the convention, as we said, starts this week. And so the runway is getting shorter for that announcement. What do you think is going to happen?
I mean, a lot of us were expecting the VP announcement on Sunday, but obviously Trump right now wisely is taking advantage of the news cycle and the fact that you know, he had a pretty good weekend with all the coverage of what happened. His announcement of his pick for the vice presidential seat could be as early as today. He might, in true Trump style, drag it out and try to create as much drama as possible. But it does certainly, between both of the attempted assassination as well as what happened with Biden during the debate, it really intensifies the focus on both vice presidential candidates, probably more so than any presidential race I can remember in recent history. You've got two older candidates, both with health issues and so forth. And I think this year, the attention on the vice presidents could be much more intense than we've ever seen before.
Because obviously this reinforces just how vital a role vice president is when you realize we're talking about an attempted assassination attempt, but this was really inches, maybe centimeters from an incredibly different story today.
Absolutely. And I think, again, you know, a lot of folks who watched the presidential debate had the same thing. It's like, okay, the reality of how close Vice President Kamala Harris is to actually maybe someday sitting in that chair, it became very real for a lot of people watching it. So I think it's going to be interesting. We'll find out this at some point this week who the vice president is on the Republican ticket. And CBS has already extended an invitation to both camps for a vice presidential debate. They've offered a date in late July and a date in mid-August. We have no idea if whoever the Trump campaign selects will accept that invitation. The Biden campaign has already said that Vice President Harris would do the debate, and she's an excellent debater. So that that event could be a lot more interesting this year than it's ever been before.
We, of course, invite your calls and comments. We have a call from Eric this morning. Good morning, Eric. You're on the air.
Hey, real quick prediction. I think that Trump is going to pick Ron DeSantis for his running mate for reasons that have to do with the Epstein trial and all that stuff that went on. I think that it's interesting. The irony of all this, which no one is pointing out, is that the Republican Party just came face to face with a problem that they've been refusing to deal with for decades, which is a emotionally disturbed young man between the ages of 18 and 25 with access to a firearm. Thanks for taking my call.
Thanks, Eric. Obviously, it does raise the whole issue of, you know, gun safety. It remains a big issue. We have a comment from Brandon on Facebook. He says the blaming of this attack on the left is pure projection by the right. They are using every excuse except taking responsibility for their fear-mongering and ratcheting of tensions. And then goes on to say that some right-wing personalities have actually been attacking Trump for not being radical enough. How does this change, John, or does it, you know, the positions of anybody that is going to vote in this election when it comes to the issue of guns, gun violence, or the environment that surrounds the current political world?
Yeah, I mean, one of the problems, you know, there was a lot of speculation and a lot of wild, irresponsible comments online this weekend. And the truth is, we still don't know much about the motives behind the shooter in this. I mean, we heard that he had given a donation to a Democratic cause. We know that he was a registered Republican. We know that he was a gun owner. But it's still very much up in the air as to exactly where he was psychologically. So it's really hard to assign blame or to try to really figure out any motives behind this. At this point, it's not stopping a lot of people from trying. Ultimately, you know, again, what the political persuasion was of the shooter, I'm not sure that's going to make a lot of difference. It certainly will fuel some rhetoric. But in the long run, the people who are going to decide this race, as we talked about earlier, this very small number of likely voters who are still persuadable, their focus is much more on the economy than issues like gun control or abortion or any of the leading issues. Those pollsters have said that those voters who are still undecided mostly are thinking about economic issues.
We also have a comment from John on Facebook. He says maybe now Joe Biden will stop telling the very fine people on both sides and Donald Trump told people to inject bleach lies, or maybe we can stop calling him a Russian agent. I guess that speaks to, John, the fact that there's so many larger divisive narratives in this, in the electorate, that you were saying how entrenched people are in terms of the messaging that they've received.
Yeah, and like I said, that stuff is going to continue. And the hardcore base for each party, you know, that throws around a lot of those terms, you know, threat to democracy and some of those really strong language, those voters aren't going anywhere. The notion that you're going to change the minds of anybody, that the 99% of voters who are firmly set on whether they're going with Trump or Biden, I don't think much of any of that kind of comment is going to change that. We're really talking about what changes the mind of a very small number of voters in six swing states who are still undecided.
John Daigle, we appreciate all of your political insights as ever. Thanks for being on the program again.
Thank you.
Up next, how Jacksonville created movie stars and sequels in its heyday as the winter film capital of the world. Welcome back. Jacksonville was once the film mecca of the country, home to more than 30 movie studios and sometimes called America's first Hollywood. That rich history is excavated in the latest installment of Bygone Jacks, Our Unsung History, which is a WJCT podcast. Joining me to talk about it is Jennifer Gray. She is the public services coordinator for the libraries of the Florida State College at Jacksonville. Hi, Jennifer. Welcome back.
Thank you. Good morning.
Bo Harris, longtime chief photographer at a couple of local television stations, also a writer and director of a local film production company called Bo Filmworks. Hey, Bo.
Hey, how are you?
Good. Nice to see you. Also joining us on the line, Brendan Rivers, formerly of WJCT's Adapt, but now host and producer of the Bygone Jacks podcast. Hey, Brendan. Good morning.
Good morning, Anne. Thanks for having me.
So, Jennifer, this series is about the heyday of filmmaking in Jacksonville. There was a period where there was more than 300 films in a period of about 10 years, and then it kind of all went away, or not all, but that era certainly came to an end. This is the third topic that you've tackled in Bygone Jacks. How did you select this in particular, the movie history of Jacksonville?
Well, most of the work from Bygone Jacksonville is a sort of offshoot of research that I did with my faculty partner, Dr. Scott Matthews, for the History of Jacksonville course at FSEJ. And one of the things that we get to touch on very briefly in that course is the silent film history of Jacksonville. But it's only a 15-week course. You can't talk about everything. And we found so much fun stuff that I was desperate for a place for it to find a home. And I was like, hey, you know what people always like to hear about? Silent film history in Jacksonville. And that's kind of the idea here. Also, it's relatively speaking, a lighter topic for the Jacksonville history. It's not quite as fraught as some other topics we could be dealing with. And I thought it would be a nice endpoint because it also highlights some of the women who get to work here. And it just all coalesced in a good idea there.
And Bygone Jacks previously has focused on Civil War history here mm-hmm. in Jacksonville. It's focused on the history of the Timaqua Indians who inhabited this region for thousands of years.
Mm-hmm.
And it does aim to find lesser known stories. So whereas people may be familiar, a lot of people are with Norman Studios in Arlington, which is really the only physical representation of that film history that remains. This is a whole other area that I had not heard about one bit until I listened to the podcast.
That's fantastic. That's exactly what we were aiming for. So I'm really glad to hear that. And yeah, Calum is mentioned usually because it was the first film company to kind of base itself here, at least over the winters, usually when it started. But most people don't really talk about it. You hear the name and then it kind of falls off and then you hear Norman Studios and then it's sort of like yada, yada, everything ended, goodbye. But there was a very, very brief stretch, about 9 years, when Calum was a real force here in the local area. And we use it as a lens to look at sort of the broader scope of Jacksonville's film history trajectory, which started very brightly and then sort of petered out for a variety of different reasons.
I want to bring in Bo Harris, though, because we're talking about old history of film, but you are very much a current filmmaker working in Jacksonville. You just won a big award. First of all, tell us what the recent recognition was and for which film of yours that you recently produced.
Well, actually, I just recently signed a distribution deal for my latest film called A Mother's Hope. And by attending a lot of different film festivals, you were able to make contact connections to these resources, send your film out and get selected. And so we're really excited about that.
You were a former colleague of mine, my chief photographer at First Coast News, but you've also worked at Action News. And you've always done a million things on the side, as I remember. Well, this is your passion, though, making films. Do you feel part of the history of film in Jacksonville, speaking broadly, or do you just feel like you're doing your work in your lane and kind of making the films that you love?
It's weird that you bring that up, because I do kind of feel like I'm just in my lane making my films and just, but there is a connection. You kind of feel that connection now that when you hear the history, like, and then just to identify you becoming a part of that history because we're in Jacksonville.
Right. That's deep. Right?
Yeah.
I mean, you are kind of part of this long history. Brendan, I want to talk to you about a couple of really cool discoveries that the podcast brings out. One is that this may have been the place where sequels were invented, that the studios, Calum Studios, that the podcast focuses on so much, were the first to create this series about a female spy. They're also responsible somewhat for the creation of the idea of a movie star. Tell us about some of those elements of the podcast?
Well, I mean, that's kind of one of the cool things about this whole project, and we can kind of have similar discoveries with previous seasons. There are so many elements of Jacksonville history that aren't widely known, but that played like really major roles in sort of a broader historical context. And yeah, you point out a couple of things, but Caitlin was responsible for so many kind of like hallmark things in the film industry today. They helped kind of birth the age of movie stars by giving credit to actors. They were kind of involved in this legal struggle that kind of helped shape our modern concept of copyright law. They wrote some of the first music that was ever written for movies. They kind of drove this trend of Civil War movies that eventually led to the birth of a nation. There's just like all these huge things that happened right here in Jacksonville that really shaped this industry that everybody pays such close attention to now.
Jennifer, I thought it was really funny that they created these massive posters of the talent that was in these films. And before that, they were almost never recognized by name or in any way celebrated by the film studios themselves.
That's right. So very early in film history, what you have to remember is that movies were not where you wanted to appear as an actor. Like, you wanted to sort of quietly go get paid for doing a movie, and then you wanted to go back to do, you know, the theater and be respected, right? So it was kind of like a good thing for the actors for a while, because it was a sort of trashy sideline that you did to make a buck. And so nobody got credited and everybody was fine with that. And I think part of the argument for that was also because they were silent films, like your performance wasn't being heard, right? So what was the whole point of it anyway? And then there was a sort of transition as movies got more popular, where Calum decided to take a page from theatrical posters, which already did exist. So this was a thing that happened in the theater where people, you know, you had your photos of your actors that were posted in the theatrical lobby or whatever, and they just ported that over to movies. And we're like, you know what we think people want to know who the hot people in this film are. And they provided that service.
And they did. And the movie theater said that there really was a demand for this, craving for knowing more about these stars.
It's almost like people like movie stars.
Isn't it crazy? There was a time that people didn't believe that was even a thing. One of the things that this podcast looks at, Jennifer, is the way that this studio, Calum, created a different kind of film when it came to war stories. Tell us about how the stories that they decided to tell about the Civil War changed perspectives and the story that was basically told about that conflict.
Okay. So when Calum first came down here, they did a variety of different things. They were very scrappy. They threw a bunch of stuff against the wall to see what worked. And as they were sort of cycling through, one of the things that they found worked was doing Civil War stories from the point of view of the South. Now, war dramas were not new by any stretch of the imagination. You had about 50 years worth of theater doing them. There were a couple of movies that had existed previously. In fact, Calum, before they came down here, had done a movie called The Days of 61, which is maybe the first Civil War film ever made. It's tough to tell in film history sometimes what was first and what wasn't. But they had an idea based on maybe some letters to the editor and film magazines that the South would be very receptive to having war stories told from the Confederate perspective. And so they tried it out. It was a hit. And then they kept doing it. They realized that this was a bankable commodity, and they were sort of mostly the only ones in that lane for a while. So they did several years worth of Confederate war films.
And boy, did it have an impact. I mean, we talk about the fact that it, you know, possibly was part of the trajectory that led to Birth of the Nation. That, of course, being, you know, a much reviled racist film, but also very influential for its time, a really long feature film also for its time, told with a focus on the myth of the Confederacy, the lost cause.
Well, I should say D.W. Griffith was probably going to D.W. Griffith no matter what Calum did. He was already working at this time. In fact, there's a story that Jean Gontier, who is the primary scriptwriter for Calum and the lead actress while she's down here, she tells a story in her memoir that she claims to have gotten D.W. Griffith started when she was actually working at a different film company, and that she gave him his break as a director. And so she sort of claims him. So he was already in the mix, but I definitely think that they made this kind of story more popular. You also have to remember that we're talking about a time when they would have been coming up on an anniversary, the 50th anniversary of the Civil War. So this was sort of in the zeitgeist, and people were just in the mood for these kind of things.
Bo Harris, the films that you make are their own niche. They are not political films, particularly. No. They're human stories, and they're generally uplifting stories. Do you think about what your audience wants when you're making a film? Or are you thinking about making a statement of some kind? Or are you just finding a story that speaks to your heart and trying to tell it?
More so lived experience, trying to find a story that speaks to my heart, basically. And you can go through a lot of different turns and, trying to deliver a message to people. And you also take in maybe embed teaching moments into different stories, just to not to have the answer, but just to have an opportunity for people to think about their own responses or their own life experiences.
As a news photographer, you went to many scenes of, you know, heartbreak, of tragedy, also some very inspirational stories that you were able to tell. Do you draw on those experiences when you're writing a film?
Absolutely. A Mother's Hope basically deals with a mom trying to answer or be the solution for everything going on in her family, not drawing on the resources that are presented, you know, to her, but she's trying to solve everything and realize that she can't.
Yeah. Where is that film available for people? I know you were saying that it's at film festivals.
Well, right now, okay, after we signed the distribution deal, so that I'm waiting for the company to tell me what platforms that we will be on. So we're in that middle gap.
To date, people have only been able to watch it, though, at film festivals. And how has the reception been?
Well, we actually also premiered it in Jacksonville back in the end of February, and it was overwhelming. People loved it. Responses on Facebook and, you know, different social media platforms. And so now I'm just, you know, sitting in the theater and listening to people's responses is actually amazing. Some things that you wrote in that you think that are not supposed to be funny, people are laughing at, and vice versa.
In a good way?
In a good way, yeah, in a good way. You're like, oh, I never thought about that. But yeah, that's funny.
Are they local actors that you're using?
Some are. We've had actors as far away as Texas. My main actors came out of Atlanta and then have to come to Jacksonville, and then you got to spend the resources to have them a place to stay, feed them, and all that. So it can be very expensive also.
Well, we're going to continue this conversation on the other side of a break. We'll be back in just a minute.
The Kummer Museum of Art and Garden's new exhibition, Fabric of a Nation, American Quilt Stories, from the Museum of Fine Arts, Boston, on view through September 29th. Visit kummermuseum.org for more information.
Wayne Hogan of the Terrell Hogan Personal Injury and Wrongful Death Law Firm. When people are hurt through no fault of their own, answering who, what, when, where, why, and how is critical to proving the truth. More at terrellhogan.com.
Hi, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, host of On Point from WBUR. Every day, On Point tries to help make sense of our world. We'll learn together, challenge our thinking, we'll meet some amazing people, and hopefully we'll have some fun too.
Today at 11, here on WJCT News 89.9.
Maybe you start your day with the news on Morning Edition and catch up later with All Things Considered? Well, news doesn't wait. Stories evolve during the day in courtrooms, financial markets, on the streets, and at kitchen tables, locally, nationally, around the world. I'm Robin Young. Each afternoon, check in with Here and Now for the news as it's happening. That's Here and Now from WBUR and NPR News.
Today at 1 on WJCT News 89.9.
I'm Jen White.
And I'm Todd Zwillick.
As this year's election campaign moves into full gear, join us every Monday.
We're leaving the horse race and the polls to the side. Instead, our focus is on the stakes of this election for you, for the country, and for our democracy.
Others will argue the odds, but elections are too important to be treated as a game. Join us for our new weekly series, If You Can Keep It. That's next time on 1A.
Today, starting at 10 on WJCT News 89.9.
Welcome back. We are continuing our conversation about a new podcast that just dropped today. The latest edition of Bygone Jacksonville focuses on the film history of Jacksonville. And I'm joined by Jennifer Gray, who works for FSCJ and also produces this podcast series. Bo Harris, who is a filmmaker, and Brendan Rivers, who is the host and producer of this episode, well, of the Bygone Jack series. Brendan, you're currently in Atlanta. You used to be here in Jacksonville. You're producing podcasts up there as well for that market. What is it that you look for when you're putting together a podcast like this in terms of content, in terms of moments, in terms of elements to keep listeners engaged?
Well, first, I want to say that this whole podcast could not have happened without Jennifer and her colleagues and all the incredible research they did. Really so much stuff that they're able to find. And that was really the start of all of it. And she found so many like great primary sources that we were able to incorporate into the show. If listeners are familiar with the NPR podcast Throughline, I was kind of looking to that as sort of inspiration for the structure for the show. So we had a lot of great volunteers, friends and coworkers and people we knew throughout Jacksonville who volunteered their time to kind of voice some of these primary sources. And then we kind of looked for what we thought could be cool, like audio scenes that we could portray in the podcast. So in these episodes, there is like a scene of Calum actors rescuing people who were like drowning in the water as they were shooting a scene. I was able to just kind of find some cool audio that we could use to kind of make listeners sort of hear that scene and feel like they were there when it was happening. One of Jennifer coworkers was generous enough to record herself playing piano. We found some piano scores for music that was actually used in some Calum films. So most of the music you hear in these episodes were actually pieces of music that you would have heard if you went to go see a Calum film at the time. So Jennifer was really able to turn up some really great resources that we were able to incorporate into the podcast that I think really helps kind of transport listeners back in time and give as accurate a picture as we could of what was happening.
We should say, Jennifer, this really is kind of a passion project of yours. I mean, you find these histories and then you convert them into a podcast to be able to share some of these unknown stories or lesser known stories. How did the film industry shape Jacksonville at the time? I mean, there was a mayor who was very supportive for a while, but the kind of bohemian nature of the filmmakers and the crews eventually chafed with the more conservative elements of Jacksonville.
Yeah, so that's actually a really open question for me that I haven't been able to settle. So the general line that you hear is, you know, filmmaking kind of got out of hand in the city of Jacksonville. They're running amok in the streets. They're, you know, smashing buildings. They're running cars off the edges of piers. Oh my God, they're filming on Sunday. How dare they? Quelle surprise. And all of that. And then it'll sort of like culminates in the loss of the mayorality by J.T. Jett Bowden to John Martin in 1917. And then it just like supposedly the filmmakers all apparently either drop dead or disappear in a puff of smoke and it's just all over, right? And as we were working on this story, we found that it seemed to be a lot more complicated than that, right? So for Calum in particular, what you were looking at is, sure, there was some of that, you know, change in political vibe, but Calum was pretty much done by the time that John Martin took the office. So you can't say, blame it all on his, like, you know, disapproval of the film community. Instead, you're looking at things like, you know, the change in the markets caused by World War One, like lack of supplies or closure of markets abroad for selling your films. You're looking at different things like the collapse of the Edison Trust, which Calum was a part of. So they were part of this big sort of monopolistic practice that was really benefiting them monetarily. And then that sort of like fizzled out in 1915. And so suddenly they're on their own. And after that, you start seeing the executives pop up in interviews being like, oh, well, the movie making business, it used to be profitable, but now we're not making any money. It's almost like when you have a monopoly, you do better than other people. So things like that happened. And then there was also like sort of a recession going on in Jacksonville, too. And banks were a little bit more unlikely to loan money. And then there were, you know, the people locally had sort of like caught on to the idea that they could make a buck off the film companies. So they used to like rent furniture for sets and things. And they're like, oh, wait, hold on. You dinged a chair leg. We're going to charge you for this entire living room set. So a lot of different changes.
There are so many considerations that go into making a film, Bo, as you well know. In terms of incentives, the state has been, you know, looking at, the city has been trying to increase incentives for local filmmaking. How much does that affect your production, your work? Are you able to take advantage of any of those? Do you rely on a better, you know, reception for filmmaking in Florida by the powers that be?
Well, the issue with a lot of filmmakers is that they're not aware of how it can impact them. And so they don't seek out, well, what can I do here? Can I cut costs by doing this? I actually didn't use any parts of any incentives until the very end, when I had to rent like I rented a gym to shoot one of our closing scenes in. And that's kind of like my extent with it. Had I known in advance, I could have taken more advantage of what opportunities that were there. So my call to any filmmaker today is to go find out how you can benefit.
Well, the new edition segment of Bygone Jacks dropped today. You can find it on your favorite podcast platform and, of course, at WJCT.org. You've been listening to First Coast Connect. Join us again tomorrow when we talk to political expert and local government lawyer Chris Hand. I'm Ann Schindler. You've been listening to First Coast Connect on WJCT News 89.9.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided in part by Baptist Health.